It's interesting that seems like every week I get a few emails, and this week I got one that I'm going to read to you right off of the top. And it's an interesting little thing. It says, "The Shoeshine Man." And this is by John Fisher. I want to read this to you. When it comes to serving one another, think of yourself as the shoeshine man. We've all seen these guys in airports, train stations, and downtown, next to the newsstands. And their workplace usually consists of two or three elevated chairs on a platform so they can work at a comfortable level. The most upscale stations have plush, leather-covered, stuffed chairs and brass stands for their feet to put their shoes there where the shiners can work around them easily. Shining shoes is a servant's position that bears images of a happy-go-lucky soul snapping his polishing cloth over shiny wingtips while cracking jokes or singing along with a radio. A successful businessman, of course, would identify with the guy on the throne. Never the one shining shoes. And yet, were Jesus here today, he would point to the shoeshine man as being the one to emulate. It's the closest thing to in our society to what Jesus did when he washed the disciples' feet. And then he told his disciples to go and do the same. He lowered himself to a place of servanthood and met the needs of those around him. Serving others begins with how you see yourself. And the Apostle Paul said, quote, "So look at Apollos and me as mere servants of Christ who have been put in charge of explaining God's secrets." 1 Corinthians 4, first verse of the NLT translation. Mere servants? You can't serve without first seeing yourself as a servant. If being a shoeshine man seems too demeaning, you may need to rethink your calling and purpose in life, because a big part of that purpose is to serve others instead of being served. And you can't serve yourself, pardon me, you can't see yourself as a servant without looking up to those around you. That's the other part of this image that works with Christ's foot-washing example. This whole arrangement puts you down and the other person up. For the shoeshine man, the customer is the VIP. The customer is on the throne and in the plush seat. Your purpose is to put others on the throne instead of insisting on being there yourself. I don't know about you, but for me, this is a radical redistribution of power. So remember today, you are a servant. You don't need recognition. You don't need attention, because it's not about you. It's about the people you serve. And if you forget, just remember the shoeshine man. That touched me when I read that little email that I got this week. And I wanted to share that with you because that sort of depicts what I want to talk about today, is service of that kind. Now, in doing so, there are a number of words, and we've talked about servant and deacons and ministers and these various words in the Bible a number of times. The word servant is often, the original Greek was doulos, D-O-U-L-O-S for those of you that want the English translation spelling for the Greek, doulos. And it means, and I'll get to that a little later, but what it literally means, and I'll read that to you. But another word is that we use is servant often is translated both servant and minister as the word diakonos. And we take that as the word from which deacon is generally taken. And I'll show you the distinction of that word from doulos a little later too. And another word that you don't see that often, and that's one that I want to dwell on somewhat today. And that word is huperetes in the Greek. It's huperetes in the Greek, and it's used five times as minister in the Bible, in the New Testament, 11 times as officer, and 4 times as servant. Now I'm going to turn to John 18 and verse 36 because I want to show you the example here that sort of really summarizes the thing beautifully as far as I am concerned. Jesus used this word. He was before Pilate. And Pilate asked him if he was a king, because he was accused of being a king. And, of course, Pilate wants somebody to take his place in kingship. So he was interested in that question, of course. But Jesus answered to him in verse 36. I just read that one verse. It says, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my huperetes, my servants would fight." My servants would fight. In his kingdom, when it finally is set up, who will be his servants? Obviously, those in their first resurrection. I think we all understand that. His servants, and he said, they would fight then. Now, their way of fighting is going to be for proper justice, as we very well know, and Jesus is going to rule in that way when he comes as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Now, that word, huperetes, is the Greek, best I can pronounce it. I hope that's approximately correct anyway. And he said, "My servants would fight." That word is a very interesting word, I think, and it's used, as I said, about 20 times all in the New Testament. And I think it's worth looking at. I brought Vine's Expository Dictionary along, and I want to read what Vine's has to say about that particular word, because, Vine's, I looked this up under minister in Vines, and he has several words here that actually are used as minister. And one of them is diakonos, and we know that one, I think, and I'll get to the meaning of it a little bit later. I can't pronounce this other one probably in the Greek the way it maybe ought to be pronounced, but it is Leitergos, and that one is another word that is sometimes translated minister or servant. But the huperetes, I want to read to you what he says about that. Huperetes, properly an under rower, R-O-W-E-R, rower. Now, you know, their ships traveled by unison of rowers in those days, and they were the underlings under guidance. He said that was the original word And I like this Vine's dictionary of the Bible so well because this man has such a tremendous grasp of the New Testament Greek that it seems supersedes anybody else that I've ever read, as far as I know, in commentaries. And he goes on to say, hence it came to denote any subordinate acting under another's direction. Any subordinate acting under another's direction. That's the way Jesus used it there. His servants, if they were his servants, and if they were the resurrected ones, they would be under his guidance and directions, obviously. We know that. He would be the leader, King of Kings. And he goes on to say here, in Luke 4 and verse 20, in the Revised Version, it is translated attendant, and the Authorized Version, that is your common King James Version, is minister. It signifies the attendant at the synagogue service. That's where Jesus was handed the scrolls, and he read it, and he said, this day this is being fulfilled in your eyes, in Luke 4 and verse 20. You can read that if you'd like. I just got it out of here. And he handed the scroll back to the huperates, to the attendant. The attendant was a man under the authority of course, the priests. And he was the attendant there in that case. And he goes on to say in Acts 13:5, it is said of John Mark, in the Revised Version, it's attendant again, in the Authorized Version, minister. And in Acts 26:16, a minister, it is said as Paul, as a servant of Christ in the gospel. So in 1 Corinthians 4:1, where the apostle associates others with himself as Apollos and Cephas as ministers of Christ. Now, I want to read this section here because it's skipping a sentence or so in here. But it says, speaking broadly, this I love the way he puts this, so simple. Speaking broadly, Diakonos views a servant in relation to his work. You don't have to tell these deacons to go out here and set up the tables. They know that's just work that needs to be done, and they do it. They don't have to be under the guidance of somebody, Diakonos. Diakonos views a servant in relationship to his work. Doulos, in relationship to his master. Now, the Bible, when God sanctioned slavery, why, they had a master over them, and they were literally purchased. Now, we have a little different view of it in our era. I'm full well aware of that, very much aware of that. But that's still the word doulos in relation to his master. Huperetes, in relation to his superior. Now, that's a little different. His in relationship to his superior, and Leiturgos, if I'm pronouncing it anywhere near correctly, actually in relation to public service. So public service servants in that sense, in administering public service would be that word. I wanted to give you Vine's definition of that because I think that man knows how to hit the nail on the head when it comes to making distinction between some of those words that are somewhat common to us in one sense of the word. But he is capable of doing that very thing, has a way of defining the differences because he knows the Greek language so well. I want to take first to the realization that word is often used well, as it is put as an underling, and it's translated officer more times than any other word. But I also want to point out that Jesus Christ himself, what would he be? Would he be under authority? Think for a moment. What did he say? He says, I don't do my own will. I do the will of my Father. Turn to 6. John, I have it right here. We'll come back to this a little later. But John 6 and verse 38, I believe it is. I think my memory tells me that much. I knew that, used to know those verses so well. John 6 and verse 38, for he says, I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. The will of the Father, in other words. Jesus then was, if you wish to put it that way, was under the authority of his Father. I don't like even the word authority when it comes to that. He was in harmony with what his Father wished. I think that's maybe a better way to put it. Always in harmony with his Father. And that's the way it should be in the usage of this word. It seems to me it's well worth looking at a few cases in this word. I want to turn to, as long as I'm here, I might as well mention chapter 5 and verse 30. I believe I want to mention that one too. Chapter 5, just one page back in my Bible. Chapter 5 of John and verse 30, it says, I can of myself do nothing. That every time I read that, I have to shake my head. Here the very creator of all things said he could do nothing. What on earth or in heaven or anywhere else could I ever do if he said, if Jesus Christ himself says I can do nothing? That has struck me so often. You know, if we only realize that God gives us the strength to breathe. Now, we take that for granted, always. And you'd be a fool if you tried to tell somebody out here on the street that truth. But God knows it all. He said every hair on your head is numbered. And no question about it. Jesus said, of myself I could do nothing. That has struck me every time I read that. But I want to go on. It says, and my judgment is righteous. He says, I can of myself do nothing. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is righteous, because I do not seek my own will, but the will of the Father who sent me. Now, he always did the will of his Father. That was fundamental with Jesus. It should be, if we're going to emulate him, which we wish to do, then we need to become like that. That every wish in our being ought to be right in harmony with what God wants. I didn't say you think exactly the same way God did. None of you think exactly like the person sitting right beside you. That's fundamental, basic. Can't do it. God made you, every one, as an individual, and you're all different. But that thinking, I think we could say the same thing of Jesus Christ and God the Father in that respect, as far as they were each individual. And as individuals, why, individuals think in their own way, can I put it that way? And it should be, they were in harmony together, he did always the will of his Father. Well, that's pretty fundamental, brethren, that's pretty basic. We should wish to do that very thing. As far as we are concerned, I want to turn to John, the 11th chapter here, and talk about the usage of this word. The word huperetes. John chapter 11 and verse 1. Is that what I want? Okay, John 11, verse 1, I think is what I want, all right. It says, now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with the fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore, his sisters went to see him. I can't read my own notes. It says chapter 18 in verses 1. Let's go back there. Scratch that 11. Chapter 18 in verse 1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went with his disciples over the brook of Kidron, and there was a garden in which he and his disciples entered, and Judas, who betrayed him, you know, that was Judas Iscariot, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. Then Judas, having received a detachment of troops and officers, huperetes, that's one of the words. He received a detachment of troops and officers. The officers were maybe comparable to officers as we have out here riding around in patrol cars, you know, officers of the law. And they were the ones that were the ones that did the work of going and putting persons in prison, etc. And officers from the chief priests and Pharisees. So the chief priests and the Pharisees were the overseers then. And the officers were huperetes, servants there. Now I want to drop on down to verse 12 here, because it says, then the detachment of troops, that ones that Judas had here, and the captain and the officers, huperetes again, that word, and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. See, the officers were the ones that were to do, oh, I almost said the dirty work. It doesn't have to be the dirty work, but the work of arresting them, doing that properly. This is the usage of it. On down to verse 18, it says, now the servants, that word was in the original was doulos. The servants and huperetes and the officers who had made a fire of coals stood there, for it was cold, and they warmed themselves. And Peter stood with them and warmed himself there. I cite those cases because of the cases of usage of the officers. I wanted to point that out here. And I think, hopefully, rightly so, wanted to show that. Now, what has this all got to do with us going to the Feast of Tabernacles? Well, I think it's everything as far as we are concerned. Now, we're going there to serve. I hope that's in your mind, in my mind. We may not look at it all that way, but everything you do, in a sense, is a service. You are a called out one. God has called you out and separated you out. And you have a responsibility at the feast everywhere you go. You're looked at as a representative of God. Now, they may not think of it that way all the time, but they observe you, and they look at that, your example, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. Sometimes it's good, and sometimes, unfortunately, it's a little bad, too. I have to speak of myself in that respect, and I'm ashamed of it, but I've made some pretty bad blunders at times, and it wasn't the kind of witness I should have been always exactly. But in the main, we're there to study to be the right kind of witness before Jesus Christ. Isn't that right? That's what we want to do. That's our very purpose, to become servants of the Master, really, as far as we are concerned. So it has, as far as I'm concerned, rather, it has everything to do with it. Now, we are fundamentally to obey the law. We have to do that. I explained in Sedgwick that we have to obey the law, and which is the first law that we have to obey. Well, God's law should come first in our minds, always. Now, if it came to the point where you had to obey the law, and the law said that you had to disobey God's law, now you have a choice. And I've given sermons on that, so I don't want to go into that in detail now, but I think you understand that principle. So when I read these scriptures about obeying the law, you understand that off of the top, I hope, because the accounts that I'm going to read don't deal with that particular aspect of it commonly, even though, you know, Peter himself, I'll talk about him a little later, or some of his writings a little later about this, and he himself knew that principle very well because he exercised it. He said we ought to obey God rather than man. And he was willing to do that if his life depended on it. So there was no doubt about that. And then I cited the case that we had some years ago. Some of you older ones may even remember this. I know it still rings in my mind that we had a man in Africa. Now, the government's a little different there. And they had to work on Saturday. No questions asked. You do the work there or you're out. That's it. And this man became converted, and he decided he was going to keep the Sabbath. He went to his boss and he told him that, I don't know if I got all of these details exactly straight, but I know the principle of it and I can tell that to you. He went to his boss and his boss said, no way. You know, you work or you're out. That's all there is to it. That was the way they function. Well, the boss went to the big boss, or however it was, and told him that you got this guy out here that wants to get off on Saturday. And they said, so they called the man in. I don't remember exactly how all that came about, but they called the man in and talked to him. And whether it was the owner of the corporation or whatever, whoever it was, anyhow, it was the big boss, called him in, and he was talking to him, and what was his idea about all of this? He's got to work on Saturday. You have to feed your family, and you have to do it. That's all there is to it. No, he said he was going to obey God. And if it required him to starve to death, he was going to obey God. Well, that touched that leader of that organization so deeply that he told his boss, he says, we are going to work with this man. We'll work through that. And they gave him Saturday off. They gave him off on the holy time that God set. Now, as I recall the story, I think Mr. Armstrong was the one that told us all about this. And he said there were Seventh-day Adventists that were there. Now, Seventh-day Adventists vary all over this patch. I guess you know that as far as they are concerned. But for that matter, I guess so do all the rest of us, too, in one sense of the word. But they vary somewhat. And these people were working there, Seventh-day Adventists working at this corporation also. And they went to the boss and said, hey, wait a minute, you allow this guy to get off on Saturday. We also keep the Sabbath. You better let us off. They said, hey, look, you've been out there working every Saturday. You back out there and go to work. That was the end of that. They didn't get off. He didn't have to tell them. This man said he would starve to death before he would not keep obey God. But they had already been working on Saturday before. And he said, get back out there and go to work. That was what, I believe it was Mr. Armstrong that told us that. And I remember that incident very well. Because the reason that I mention it, even, is because if the chips are really down, comes right down to where you'd be willing to starve to death, would you do it? in order to obey God rather than man. I believe Abraham was. We don't have to go through the example when he went. We've gone through that a number of times when he had to take his son, and God took him all the way to the point where he raised the knife, and then God said, "That's enough. Now I know. Finally." You see, God wanted to know absolutely for sure. And he found out. Now I know. And he told Abraham, and then he supplied him a sacrificial animal in the bushes right there beside it. You know that. I don't have to turn to Genesis 22 and read all that to you. You'll find it there if you want to read the account. But you see, dedicated to God totally and completely in service to Him is a conscience, a mindset that we need to see. We need to have our mind set to do that. Now, I'd like to think that I was that way totally and completely, but I'm not kidding myself, brethren. I know that circumstances could arise that would test me severely in that. But and God tested Abraham severely after he had been his servant for years and years. But finally he says, now I know absolutely and for sure. We could face trials maybe more severe than we can even imagine in one thing. But my question is, if it came right down to that final level, is God big enough to protect you? If you really have the mind to do it. Now, if you don't, God knows that too. Some will die. Sorry to say, but that's already scripture, you know. I don't have to go into those, I don't think. That's not my purpose here in this. My purpose here is to simply show you the fact that when we go as to the Feast of Tabernacles, we should go there as being servants of God. Everywhere you go and whatever you do, we might think, well, what service can I administer? Well, you can administer, as I said, the service of being right out there and before the public to see you and to see your conduct and your way of doing everything. And believe me, they respect that. I've experienced that enough times myself, and I've made enough mistakes, I'm sorry to say, that, and I've had to deal with enough things in the many, many years that I've been in the feast and had positions of responsibility of dealing, especially with housing. I could tell you stories about dealing with housing whenever it's incredible what happens whenever you have a mistake that made at headquarters and two people are assigned to the same housing unit or something like that, and then they come there and there'd almost be a hair pulling contest if you wasn't right there to stop them. And there are situations like that. I have seen them. I've been in it. I've been the one to intervene in situations like that, and so I know what I'm talking about. Does that mean they're not Christian? They haven't learned it all yet. Where are we as far as we are concerned? You know, I have to ask myself that. What would it take for me to turn away? And I want to say absolutely nothing. I want to say like Abraham did when God told him to sacrifice his son, he just did it. Now, it's an incredible frame of mind and attitude that is needed for that. That's what I wanted to point out. I said I would talk about obedience to the laws of the land. Turn to Romans 13. I said I would turn there. Romans 13 and verse 1. It says, let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. Now, I mentioned that the Apostle Paul himself, of course, knew that God's law comes ahead of everything else. In fact, he was the one that taught us all of this in Philippians and so forth. I won't go into that. But he was the one that wrote this, and his mind here is on obedience to the laws of the land, obviously. And we should all know that. that every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God. And the authorities that exist are appointed by God. That's pretty straightforward. As I said, God gives us every breath of air that we breathe. He puts everybody in positions, whether they really know it or not. Most of them don't, I might say. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God. Now, I said that's under the conditions that it not violating God's law, of course. And those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. Verse 3. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Now, the policemen generally, I know there can be a bad policeman too, and that's true of any occupation. There can always be a bad apple. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about in the main. They're there to protect us and to help us to be protected. The rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you'll have praise from the same. He who is God's minister... And that word is not the word that is commonly that I was talking about here. This word is dikanos in the original Greek. But for he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath to him who practices evil. I have dwelled on that long enough, that those who practice evil. If you make a mistake, that's different than just having that as a practice that goes on. Go on making that mistake, that's an altogether different thing. God will forgive if an attitude is right. Even if we blunder and make a mistake along the way, there's no question that God will forgive that. If he didn't, none of us would be here. I know that. I'm painfully aware of that myself. Therefore, you must be subject not only for, not because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. We need to have it in our minds and conscience to obey God first, foremost, and always. And if God tells us to obey the law, then we obey it. If they exercise it somewhat wrongly, as long as it doesn't make us violate his laws, we still got to go with it. I said that so many times when President Clinton was the President of the United States. I said, I don't really respect the man for the things that he did, but I do respect his office. I do respect the office because God allowed him to be there and in that office. I say that about anybody in that office. But, for conscience sake, we should have our conscience set to be obedient even to the laws of the land. And we should do that certainly when we go to the Feast of Tabernacles. I said I would turn to Peter. Let's turn to 1 Peter, the second chapter. 1 Peter chapter 2, and let's see what the Apostle Peter said about that. I want to start in verse 11, I believe. Yes, if I can read my notes properly here. 1 Peter, the epistle of 1 Peter, chapter 2, verse 11. Beloved, I beg you, as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul. And we have a world full of fleshly lusts. Can I just be blunt about it today? It's horrible out there. It really is. Probably as bad as it's ever been in all of the history of mankind, in one sense of the word. And because God destroyed all of mankind except eight souls whenever it got that bad. And he says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. And we're almost there, brethren. It's got about that bad. verse 12, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles. Very important, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles. That word Gentiles, I usually say non-Israelites. It covers them all, non-Israelites. That when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works which they observe, glorify God. When? In the day of visitation. Doesn't say right then and there. But they're going to remember it. And hopefully there will be a time whenever they will know that. And they will remember, I saw that. I saw the benefit of someone that really did obey God then. And when that day of visitation comes, you know that I have told you before, Revelation 7, verses 9 to 14 tells us that multitudes are going to come out of great tribulation, and God has a purpose for tribulation. And maybe they will have seen your good example. Think about that. You see, which they observe, they'll observe that, glorify God in the day of visitation. Verse 13, therefore submit yourself to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or to governors as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good. Just the same thing that the Apostle Paul said in Romans 13. They're set there to stop the evil and to praise you for doing good and honorable. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorant of foolish men. And that happens on occasion. They're dumbfounded by the goodness that they can see. As free, yet not using liberty as a cloak for vice, but as bond servants of God. God owns us, in other words. There's no doubt about that. Outright. And we should consider ourselves in that slavery kind of a situation. I want to be under God's ownership, if you please. Let's see, where did I stop? Verse 17. Honor all people. Now, that's sometimes a little hard to do. You know, Jesus said, love your enemies, and if they slap you on the one cheek, turn the other also. That's not easy. And it's a little different kind of a frame of mind and attitude. As this man said in this item here that I read, he says, I don't know about you, but where did I catch that? I'll get it here finally. It says, I don't know about you, but for me, this is a radical redistribution of power. It sure is. I'll assure you, I wouldn't like that when I was younger. I'm sorry to say that, really. Because I should have been, but I wasn't. I would have fought a buzzsaw back then, I'm sorry to say, but shame on me. But it is a radical redistribution of power. I think that we all ought to realize that that is actually true. We have to recognize that eventuality. Let's see. Verse 18 of 2 Peter 2, verse 18. Servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. Why? God put them in positions, every single one, whether they do it right or whether they do it wrong. God put them there. For this is commendable, verse 19. If because of conscience toward God, there's the key to it all. conscience toward God endures grief, suffering wrongfully. Now, I think I'll quit there on that particular thing, but I think that we ought to realize that the Apostle Paul taught his ministry. Titus, let's turn to Titus. Titus, the third chapter, and the first two verses. Titus chapter 3, and verses 1 and 2. The Apostle Paul telling Titus, he wrote this epistle to Titus, remind them to be subject to rulers and authorities. Remind them to do that, to be obedient to the laws of the land. To obey, to be ready for every good work. To speak evil of no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility to all men. Now, that was the instruction that the Apostle Paul gave to Timothy, one of the ministers under his charge and under jurisdiction. You see, we got to be taught to have a conscience in honor to serve God. That should be our whole purpose in life. Matthew 25. I want to turn to that example. We've turned to it before, after he talked about the 10 virgins and went on, and it's a continuation of all of that. In Matthew 25 and starting in verse 31, it says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory, and all the saints will be gathered before him, and he'll separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he'll set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Why? For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you as a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? In verse 20 and 39, when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to him, Assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me. Then he will also say to those on his left hand. I will stop there, and I want to read another little email I got. This one is very interesting, too. I thought it was a lesson. As the heading of this is, here's a lesson in this, even if it's not true. And, of course, we know it's not true. As soon as I read it, you'll know it's not true. But it's a lesson, and it's an interesting lesson. It says, a holy man was having a conversation with the Lord one day, and he said, Lord, I'd like to know what heaven and hell are like. And the Lord led the holy man to two doors, and he opened one of the doors, and the holy man looked in, and in the middle of the room was a large round table. In the middle of the table was a large pot of stew, which smelled delicious and made the holy man's mouth water. The people sitting around the table were thin and sickly. They appeared to be famished. They were holding spoons with very long handles that were strapped to their arms, and each found it possible to reach into the pot of stew and take a spoonful, but because the handle was longer than their arms, they could not get the spoons to their mouths. And the holy man shuddered at the sight of their misery and suffering. And the Lord said, "You have seen hell." They went to the next door and opened the door, and it was exactly the same as the first one. There was the large round table and the large pot of stew, which made the holy man's mouth water. And the people were equipped with the same long-handled spoons strapped to their arms. But here, the people were well-nourished and plump, laughing and talking. And the man says, "I don't understand." "It's simple," said the Lord. "It requires but one skill. You see, they have learned to feed each other, while the greedy think only of themselves." I think that's a pretty good lesson. And I wanted to read that there because I think it kind of fits with what Jesus said in the governing here. Verse 41. "Then he'll also say to those on the left hand, 'Depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me.' Then they will also will answer him, saying, 'Lord, when did we ever see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not minister to you?' Then he will answer them, saying, 'Assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of these, the least of these, you did not do it to me.'" They hadn't learned to feed one another. "And those will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life." I think there's a tremendous lesson that's there about having the conscience and will to serve God. Now, I mention this because it seems every year I always usually give a sermon before the Feast of Tabernacles asking people to have a mind of service before God. And I came across this particular example on the email, and it touched me so deeply I started studying that word, and I found out that the servants of God are really under His jurisdiction, very gladly so. And I want to be in that group, particularly. I think that we need to recognize that as far as we are concerned in going to the Feast of Tabernacles. You see, one day all will have the conscience of doing that. But there's a quiet and awful lot of things to go on in between. And before that all happens, but that's the way God's kingdom will be. And, well, you see, when it gets there finally, then everything will really, truly be at one with God. Well, the Day of Atonement comes next Monday, so I hope to see you then. And we should go to the Feast of Tabernacles with that kind of a frame of mind and attitude of willingness to be of service, well, to everybody, as God says, as having a mind and attitude. God is a servant of all, and we know and realize that. And we want to emulate Jesus Christ, and so we want to become like that.